You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My guest today is Juan Bendaña, who is a highly sought-after speaker, entrepreneur, and coach, having built high-impact leadership programs for companies such as Disney, American Express, and Zillow. He's got a new book. It's called Confident by Choice, the three small decisions that build everyday courage. You're going to enjoy this podcast. Juan Bendaña, welcome to the pod.
Kelly, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
In the introduction to your new book, you relate a story from school where an English teacher said to you, quote, "Some people were born with the gift of communication. You were not," end quote. So funny now, that is a terrible thing for an adult to say to a kid.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, it was one of those things that she said when I was a kid, and I carried them with me for years.
Sure.
You know, she said, communication is a gift you're born with and you were not. You can't even communicate well. I suggest you not pursue a career that requires you to do so. I'm giving you a grade to pass mostly because I don't want to see you again.
Wow.
And as a kid, you know, you internalize those things. You take those things to heart. And then I carried them for years after my run-in with her. And it's funny how oftentimes someone can give us a comment or a insecurity, and then we take it on and we're like, great, yeah, I'll carry this for the next decade, or I'll carry this for the next so far along. You carry it for a season of your life or into the next career. And yeah, it was one of those pivotal moments where years later I was like, wow, I'm still thinking about what Miss H said in English class. This is crazy.
There's, you know, we've been doing the podcast for like 10 years. There are so many stories from a variety of authors that start with a teacher like this who you don't name, but you could.
Yep.
And I wonder, is this because of your ethnicity? Because you are the well-known ethnicity of Nicaraguan Canadian.
Yes.
Which is a little unusual, I guess.
A little bit. And growing up in Canada, you know, I grew up in just outside of Toronto. I was often the first Juan people had ever met. So
sure. When
you're different, sometimes you interpret that as being wrong. And you didn't, I never felt like I belonged in any one category. So I would sort of chameleon to fit into every category. Mm-hmm. So I would hang out. I had friends that were on the soccer team and the football team. And then I had friends in drama class and actually in improv, and then I became the coach of the improv team.
Oh.
And Miss P was the teacher that on the other side of it was my drama teacher, that was the encouraging voice that told me, like, hey, you actually have something here. But I think it was a pretty hard initial journey to navigate, and thinking that I'm like, yeah, I don't, because people look at me and think, like, your name is Juan, you look like a Brandon, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's like, wait, am I? And I would get the comments all the time of like, oh, you're adopted, right?
Oh,
you're like, where'd your parents find you?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some would be brushed off. Others would be like, well, what the heck is wrong with me? Why aren't I normal or fit into the mold of what people want? You know? So, yeah, that definitely played a part for sure.
So, couple things out of this. One, words matter. Like, they're hugely important. And not just the words that people say to us, but also the words we say to ourselves. And we'll talk about that. But also, We are social creatures. Our relationships are hugely important. And you had a friend who was kind of the person who got you on this new path, right?
Yeah, my friend Luis. This was really one of those dire moments in life where you just turn to anywhere where you could find reprieve from your situation to say, like, I need things to be different. You know, I was 75 pounds overweight, obese, had binge eating disorder. Food was then not really enough. So then I turned to alcohol and I was drinking 3 days a week. Then that turned into 4 days a week and then 5 days a week. And then I was like, I knew something needed to change. And my friend Luis was that guy that was, didn't have it all figured out, but he had enough figured out. You know, he hadn't made it, but he was well on his path to making it. And I was like, I need a little bit of that. I need a little bit of that to rub off on me. So he was really the first person that showed me the version of life to be like a successful person. It's like, oh, making your bed in the morning and like eating healthier food and waking up a little earlier and winning the day and not rolling out of bed at 10, procrastinating on what you said you were going to do until 12, doing it maybe until 1, and then calling it at 2. Like, he was just a different version of life that I wasn't used to. And I was like, yeah, I need some of that. He was that first person for me.
So I'm curious for you, because what is very true for me is I've been steeped in improvisation my entire adult life, but I didn't really start applying it off stage until I was like a good decade and a half into it. And you talk about this need to get on the other side of discomfort, but it's also sort of shaking hands with discomfort because that's where all the good stuff lay. Mm-hmm. That is such a thing in improv.
Yes.
But turns out it's a thing in life as well, right?
Yes. 100%. It's, I realized that initially I thought the game was to overcome the thing you're afraid of. You just get over it. But the challenge with that is once you get over one, five more representatives show up, and every next level demands a different version of you. So I realized it's actually about building a better relationship with fear and building a better relationship with discomfort, which so often is, and I honestly learned that initially in improv, where it's like you have to be in the scene where you have no idea what is to come next, and you have to bask. My drama teacher would always say, you have to bask in the uneasiness. You have to enjoy the discomfort and not try and rush to a moment in the scene that you know you're going to get a guaranteed laugh. Don't rush to the part of the story in life where you know things are going to go well. You know, so there's such parallels there where it's like you have to be able to sit in the moment where you don't want to be for long enough to learn the lesson you need in there, and then you move on to the next moment with a little more wisdom that you gain from being in the dirt, you know? So yeah, that was a huge, huge realization.
It's so hard. I mean, this is the thing. It doesn't get easier, but your ability to do it more regularly requires practice. And unfortunately, that is a skill set that you look at, like, oh, where does that get taught in which grade level? Oh, when I'm doing a training program for going into this job, where did they teach? No one teaches it. And it's sort of like, I don't know, man. It's increasingly frustrating to me to look at why we've settled for educational systems that are outmoded, why we've settled for going into jobs that do not train us to do the jobs that we're asked to do. And I know what you're doing in this book is providing people a sense of agency for themselves to do it, which is good, and we need that. But the systems also need to change.
Yes. The fact of the matter is that no one will change our lives for us. We need to participate in our own transformation and what we want to create. But also, sometimes the conditions on the field are not what you want, are not advantageous for what you are looking to create, especially for, let's say, the younger generation that's coming into the workforce right now. It is the hardest job market in the history of the world today. It's the hardest time to get a job, the hardest time to get an opportunity. So how do you sit in that moment of, I don't know what the next few months is going to look like? How do you sit in that moment where I'm not sure if this is going to go one way or the other? like, you know, I talk about this idea of practicing courage, because I don't think courage is a destination you reach. I think it's a muscle you train. Mm-hmm. It's something you develop, where sometimes we get to a level of success, quote unquote, and often success does not beget more success. Often it begets complacency.
Yeah.
Because you get to that certain level and you're like, great. And then you kind of downshift. Mm-hmm. And then you coast and you put it on cruise control and you're like, yeah, I guess things are good. I guess things are all right. I'll stay right here. So I think reminding ourselves to say, I'm going to pursue discomfort. I'm going to pursue challenge. I'm going to pursue things outside of what I find comfortable. That's where all the growth lies. That's where the next level is for most people.
Let's talk. You have a thing you talk about, the four confidence myths. Let's go through them. Extroversion is the first one. So merely being an extrovert does not make you confident.
Yeah, we found in the research of, you know, leading up to this book, is that oftentimes extroverts actually have more insecurities than their introverted counterparts, because mm-hmm. they're trying to prove something. They're trying to put on this persona. You know, the loudest person in the room is often the ones that have the loudest insecurity. So there isn't a strong correlation between, oh, if you're extroverted, you are more likely to be confident. That is not the case, because there's very confident introverts, people that are more reserved, and they just have this steadfast movement toward what they are doing, who they're becoming, and they don't need to be sort of, you know, bolsterous in the way that they communicate. So yeah, because before I thought, oh, extroverted people, they just have all the confidence in the world. Oftentimes it's just overcompensation for a lack of self-confidence and really insecurity.
Yeah. Okay. Next one, zero insecurities. So that, I guess that one's easy in the sense that, like, that's not a thing.
100%. Like, and it's funny because confident people I've found, it's that they don't, it's not that they have less insecurities. They are just willing to face their insecurities,
yeah,
look themselves in the mirror and say, this is something I want to improve. You know, confident people don't see self-doubt as a sign to stop. This is one of the biggest sort of misconceptions we saw. They don't see it as a sign to stop. They see it as a signal to get better. Mm-hmm. That's the distinction. That's the difference between confident people and their less confident counterparts, is that confident people, they instead of running away from challenges, they run toward them. So yeah, they got all the insecurities in the world. They have just decided to not let those run the conversation.
Okay. Number three is genetics.
Yeah, you know, early on, I thought there were certain people that were born with confidence.
Right.
And that it was just a tendency to not be so in your head and just be able to be present. Though there is some people, and you see this with some kids, just have all the confidence in the world and they feel really great and they're charismatic and it's odd. Like, some people do have that. They're a little ahead in the race, but for the most part, our confidence is shaped by the experiences that we go through and the people that are a part of them. That's what informs the beliefs that we have about the world and the beliefs that we have about ourselves. Just like if someone goes to public speak in front of 1,000 people and they get booed off stage, that experience is going to inform how they feel about themselves, not whether they were born with confidence or not. So we've found our experiences shape our confidence far more than our genetics do.
Yeah, I know in my case, because I am an extrovert, I speak in front of large crowds, and my wife always laughs at me because there are other parts of my life in which I just like wilt. And she's like, how can this person who does, you speak in front of like 5,000 people and you're not worried about in the least, and yet you're confronted with this, like, you know, a phone call that you will not do. And so I think that the key in understanding that is we all contain multitudes, like, you know, and everything's on a spectrum.
100%.
And that also ties into your last one, which is competence, which you would think that if you had competence, of course you have confidence. But then you start going through the Rolodex in your mind of the people you know. And I would tell you this, the most competent people that I've worked with suffer from a lack of confidence. That is often the case.
Yes, 100%, because there's two sort of things that, not to get too nerdy about it, but there's two things that really make up the way that we feel about ourselves, and there's a difference between the two. One is self-esteem, one is self-efficacy. Self-efficacy is basically your ability to do something. You're really good at swinging a golf club. You have a high level of self-efficacy. You may have a level 9 or 10 efficacy. Self-esteem is the way you see yourself in right. that context. And what we've found is that there's a lot of people that have a level 10 self-efficacy, but a level 2 esteem, and they're wondering why they're not able to maximize that talent or that ability. And then we see the inverse, where it's like someone that has a level 10 self-esteem, but a level 2 efficacy, and oftentimes that's arrogance. And they think they're the best in the world, but they're not very good. And they have sort of this distorted sense of self. So I think the goal is really to have our esteem match our efficacy, to have belief in our ability. Like, what is confidence? It is the belief in our ability to perform, to do something, to figure something out. So I think a lot of times people have all the skill set in the world. They have all the talent in the world. But the way that they see themselves, they get in their own way with these stories of, yeah, but. You know, it's different than the yes and. It's, yeah, but that was one time. Yeah, I know that was great, but I couldn't do it again. Yeah, I was consistent, but I probably won't be for the next few weeks. Yeah, but they probably didn't like it as much as they like them. Mm-hmm. So we kind of like, we create these justifications as to why we shouldn't have a strong sense of belief in our ability that hinders our ability to feel good and have a great level of esteem and self-image of who we are. So yeah, a lot of times those numbers are a little distorted in a way.
In the first maybe month of doing the podcast, I had Gretchen Rubin on, and she is the person who introduced me. I don't know why I never knew this term before, me search, that often... a lot of people in academia and other areas, the thing they're studying is, of course, the thing that they want to change in themselves. And your story is front and center in this book. And I'm just curious, for your own journey, was it one of like, at that point where you're like, oh, was it after you made the switch, after things sort of got better, that you're like, I want to now know what the science of that was, or was this always something that you were sort of playing with along your journey?
Yeah, I think it was a mix of both, but I would say the majority of it was just figuring out and trying to reverse engineer what the heck just happened. I was told all my life that you are this way. You are someone that is depressed. You are someone that suffers from this disorder, which, by the way, you are not going to fix. You have this condition. I had so many people tell me all of these different things. And then when I overcame those things, all of those things, I was like, wait, how the heck did that happen? And then I started to try and like decode what I did, so that I can like share it with other people. Cause people would ask like, what did you do? And I'm like, I kind of know, but I didn't really know. So the confidence cycle is really this like happy accident in that, like, yeah, I gave energy to this area of life I wanted to build confidence in. I developed courage by stepping into the moment of discomfort, by having the willingness to put myself into fear, into uncertainty, into discomfort. And that facilitated then action. Action gave me proof that, whoa, I am the person that I said I was going to be. And then that allowed me to pour more energy in. I was like, whoa, that's exactly what I did. And I could actually draw that to so many other use cases. And now having that be applied to different organizations and different leadership teams and executives and see how it could apply in what they're going through and how they can develop and grow. It's just, it's given me the proof, so to speak, that like, whoa, this actually works. This is crazy. Yeah. And yeah, so I think it was mostly a case study. Like I felt like the test lab mice that was like, yeah, okay, this works. Let's go run some more tests on it and go from there.
So I don't when I book the podcast, I'm working with publicists and they're not in any sort of order. It's just like when I can slot stuff in. But I did just look up and I'm like, oh, I recorded a podcast with Anne-Laure LeCompf, whose book is called Tiny Experiments. Huh. So right away, it ties into a thing that you talk about in chapter two. And this starts with a story about Bill Bowerman. So can you tell us who that is and how that fits into that chapter?
Yeah, Bill was the running coach at the University of Oregon. And he had this athlete that came onto his team named Phil. And he was like, Bill was kind of this like mad scientist when it came to running, because he was literally, this is a true story, he would take the runners on his team, he would take their shoes out of their lockers, he would rip them apart, he would take them home and use kitchen appliances to alter the shoes, alter the midsole, change even the shoelaces. He would change things about the shoe, come back, give them to his runners and say, go run a mile. Mm-hmm. And see how you do. He was kind of just like experimenting, tinkering. And Phil, one of his runners, basically was like, whoa, we can cut off some serious time here. These shoes are pretty innovative. And they found that 55, that 1 ounce off of a running shoe equated to 55 pounds of drag over a mile, wow. Which for a runner is a massive difference. That is huge. So basically, Phil was like, hey, we should partner and start selling these shoes out of the back of my car. And they did. And the shoes kind of sold out to different athletes at the University of Oregon and then at other schools. And then it kind of snowballed from there. And that was, you know, $50 billion ago. And Phil was the founder of Nike, Phil Knight. And Bowerman was his running coach at the University of Oregon. And the tiniest change that so many people said, that's not going to make a difference. Like, he literally put the sole of their shoes on an iron, like a kitchen appliance, and like melted it down, mm-hmm. to see how they could tweak the bottom of the shoe so that it could grip better and give the runners a boost in performance. But it was like a 1 ounce change, and it really changed the running industry in probably the most significant way in history.
So this is completely true across all disciplines in your life and your work, which is, you know, sometimes you just have to start. You know, we'll call it a crappy first draft. We'll call it like call a friend with a weird idea you have, see what they say. Like things just don't. We have a phrase in our work, bring a brick, not a cathedral.
So,
you know, you start with your brick. Everything's co-created. You don't know if something's going to hit in the universe until you give it to the universe. And I remember we had BJ Fogg on the podcast.
No way.
Yeah. And you talk about him in the book. And I love this story about him, because it was like, he wanted to get himself to floss, right?
Yeah.
And so He did what sounds like the stupidest thing in the world, which is floss one tooth every day.
It's insane. It's funny, because like, you nailed it. It sounds like the most ridiculous thing. And oftentimes the most ridiculous thing lead to compounding effects that afterward people see the unreasonable outcome and they're like, whoa, how'd you do that? That's really cool. You know? But it's the tiniest thing that people like, they question the smallest thing, but there's this compounding effect when you make a decision that is going to move you forward and help you progress, that makes all the difference in the world. Yeah, I thought the one tooth is like, that's one of my favorite examples in the book. It's crazy.
So the other thing from that book that I did, I work out every morning. I used to not. Part of the reason I work out every morning is I put out my workout clothes on the steps that go up to where my workout room every morning. And I do make my bed every morning. So there's these different things that it was like, oh, okay, let me just try this. And indeed, you know, over time, it doesn't all happen right away.
Yep.
But this is, we are not, again, we're not taught this. These are new ideas for people. All right, you say in the book, quote, numerous studies have concluded that play is a key ingredient in learning and productivity, end quote, amen. How do you utilize I know you have a bit of an improv background, but how do you utilize play as an adult living in the world today?
Yeah, in now what I do with organizations and doing presentations and going into an annual conference or a leadership meeting or an offsite or retreat, bringing something outside of the traditional corporate presentation of here is the content and here is how you can use it as a business use case. Some of the most memorable parts of the keynotes that I deliver now from directly from audiences is the story that I tell of almost, you know, dying, going shark diving with my now wife in Hawaii. Like, people still remember that. I tell the story of my English teacher and like bringing that level of entertainment to the mix. It's what people really remember. Cause, and I think I forget who says this quote, but it's something that has rung so true for me. The fact that information without emotion is not retained.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot remember where you were April 4th, 2010, but you can remember where you were when you met love of your life, wife, husband, best friend. Yeah. You graduated, you got the job, you closed the deal. You remember the day because emotion was attached. So I think bringing some of that emotion and some of that entertainment, some of that fun and joy to my like professional work has been one of the biggest ROIs I think I could ever imagine. Because people don't, like, as Maya Angelou said, people don't remember what you said. They remember how you made them feel. Nothing makes people feel something more powerfully than bringing some level of fun and joy to the mix.
And it's a two-way street, right? So we know this power of storytelling on other individuals to hear our messages. But if we're not telling ourselves a kind story of ourselves,
yes,
we're gonna be running into some walls.
100%.
So that's the thing. I mean, that's a thing that's also a little bit hard to know how to practice. Because I think in many ways it is easier for us to be gentle with other people than it is with ourselves.
Yeah, 100%. If you were to talk to other people the way that you talk to yourself, you'd probably have no friends. You know, like you would not at all. And I think one of the ways that can help, because it's never easy to believe in yourself, which is essentially what positive self-talk is, like having that level of belief of like, you're great. You're pretty great. You're consistent. Mm-hmm. Is giving yourself proof that you are who you say you are. You know, if you're saying, I'm someone that works out every single morning, and you consistently don't do that, you're not going to have confidence in your commitments. So the first step, I think, that is really helpful for people that maybe say, hey, I don't have a whole lot of confidence, is just start making commitments to yourself and keeping them.
Yeah.
Just start making little commitments to yourself. I'm going to go to bed at this time. I'm not going to look at my phone for the first hour of the day. I'm going to go walk 10,000 steps for the month of January. Like, just make little commitments to yourself. And then once you start keeping them, it's almost like, oh, you are who you say you are. That's pretty cool. And then you kind of give yourself a pat on the back. And then once enough of those happen, they start to compound on each other. And then it becomes a lot easier to give yourself that unwavering belief, you know?
Yeah. And again, it's going to be uncomfortable, right? So I read a quote yesterday. This is for an upcoming podcast, and it wasn't by the author. It was a mentor of hers, a rabbi. I'm forgetting his name. The quote was, the safest place for a ship is the harbor, but that's not what ships were made for.
Ooh.
Isn't that good?
I'm writing that down.
No, I stole it. You should steal it. It's
so good.
Really, I think a very gentle way of speaking to something that is very hard. You know, but we are built to go out. We're social creatures. We're built to be, and you know, we're going to get dinged around. And you do also say in the book, in addition to don't lie to yourself as a way of good self-talk, but also you got to rest. There's got to be moments where you just sort of like take it easy. But yeah, it's not, I think what I like about the book and clear from your journey, which is like, it's not like you snapped your fingers and it's all fine now. This is an ongoing practice and it's hard.
100%. It's something that you train and you develop, and every next level, you mentioned it before, Kelly, like, you know, if things don't get easier, you just get better at handling hard.
Yeah. Yeah. The hard piles up, guys. I mean, it's obvious, right? You're going to lose people, and you're going to lose pets, and, you know, you're going to have health stuff, all that thing. And it is your mindset, your body set, the people you surround yourself with, all those things contribute to your ability to navigate life's difficult journey.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
You talk in the storytelling bit, you talk about Stan Lee, and superheroes. And I thought that was, your view on this is maybe a little bit different than people who, you know Stan, and his work, but, talk to us about that section of the book.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm a little biased because Marvel's my favorite, my favorite franchise of all time, but before, you know, initially when Stan was, and in, if you haven't already, like, look into reading about Stan Lee and his story and his come up, because it's unbelievable. But superheroes before Stan were very much so that they were superheroes. They were perfect. They had no challenges. And he came in, he's like, what if we made them have some of the complex human traits and challenges that we deal with? Like, wouldn't people be able to connect to that more? And a lot of the executives were like, whoa, I don't know if this is the right thing. That the reason why people like superheroes is because they're so great and they have these superpowers and all this sort of stuff. And then he goes ahead and sketches out Spider-Man, who was bullied at school and who was living with his Aunt May and who was insecure and going to school. And then he, you know, you had Captain America and then Iron Man, who is dealing with his own sort of like inner torment and challenges. And like, then you had a group of people that the audience could then connect to because of their humanity, because of their challenges. And I think there was such a parallel in the world that we live in today, because people falsely prop up these perfect brands and thought leaders, quote unquote, not realizing that the people we really connect to are the ones that say, I've had a really tough morning. I slept in, my back is kind of tweaked, I don't know what's going on. Like, that's what we connect to, because we understand that perfection isn't real life. And I think every one of us knows and has a part of ourselves that understands that we like seeing someone that has challenges and despite their challenges still win.
Yeah.
That's really exciting.
I don't want to see your pretty vacation photos, but if you've got a fiasco, I am here for it. I want your fiasco.
Yeah. All day long.
This is at the heart of good storytelling. It's the heart of good comedy. It's what great leaders do. My friend Sunil Gupta always talks about the fact that it's not charisma that's more important, it's confidence.
Yes.
And some of the most confident people in the world are not necessarily charismatic.
Yep.
So, yeah, all those things. All right, we always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yeah, and I was thinking about it. I think to kind of bring this full circle, my yes and moment was when I was living at home with my parents, basically had no money, was 70 or so pounds overweight at the time, binge eating almost every day. And my friend Luis said, hey, why don't you come to California? I was like, I was living in Canada. That's a 5-hour flight away. That's expensive. I don't think I can go. He's like, I think you need just a new environment. You need a fresh start. You need something different. And I decided to say yes. And what happened afterward was I got there and decided that that was going to be the demarcation line from the old me to the new me. And I am not a health and fitness professional, and I do not advise doing what I did, but I got there and I basically ate like 4 plates of steamed vegetables a day. It's a true story. That is basically all I ate, with eggs at times. I worked out 2 to 3 times a day. I took his sleep regimen and his sleep schedule as my own. And in the next 6 months, I lost the 75 pounds and basically transformed the person that I was before, you know, and I left, I think, like 15 of those pounds in California. Just left those there. But it was the ignition point and it was the start that I needed to get in the game of growth, because I just hadn't been in that game for so long. But I would say that was the biggest, that was the most transformational yes and moment for sure.
I love it. The book is called Confident by Choice, The Three Small Decisions That Build Everyday Courage. Juan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Kelly, thanks so much for having me.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.